And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Today's program is with historian Professor Laurent Dubois. He's written a new study of the long, difficult history of Haiti. His book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History, and he joins us from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to you, Professor.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And welcome. You began to write this book, Aftershocks of History, just one day after the earthquake, I understand. Why was that?
Well, it was a kind of a very emotional moment, obviously, for all of those connected to Haiti. And as we were thinking, mourning and trying to understand what was going on, I couldn't help but go back and think about the ways in which the history of the country was shaping the kind of disaster and would shape the response to the disaster. Haiti and the United States in particular have a very complicated history. And so I was looking ahead as well as looking back in trying to understand how history could help inform the present and perhaps contribute to the reconstruction process.
So the aftershocks in the title means more than just a reference to the earthquake. Expound on that.
Well, really, the book is constructed around the argument that there have been a series of aftershocks of history going back to the foundation of the country in slavery and then the overthrow of slavery by Haitians in this kind of remarkable revolution in the late 18th century. And I argue in the book that you really need to go back to those foundations and then the ways not only in which Haitians tried to build a new society but also the very negative and often hostile ways in which people responded to Haiti to really understand the complex web and networks that have created the situation today. So that's the kind of – in some ways it's the original kind of revolution and the founding of this new society that is the kind of original push. And these are the aftershocks of history are the various ways that has continued throughout the last two centuries.
We want to go back over this two-century history with you, but I just want to talk a little bit about the earthquake. It's been almost 3 years to the day since the earthquake. Do you feel the recovery efforts have been at all successful?
Well, I think 3 years on, actually, there's quite a bit of disappointment and kind of rancor around the reconstruction process, honestly. There have obviously been some very important moves and some things built, a new teaching hospitals going up with Partners in Health. And there's other projects that I would say have been successes. But globally, I think we really have to take stock of what has gone wrong in this reconstruction effort and the ways in which perhaps a kind of insufficient understanding of the complexities of Haitian culture and history contributed to some of those failures.
So what do you think have been the major obstacles in rebuilding?
I mean, I think partly, you know, there was a moment after the earthquake where everyone thought this was a terrible opportunity but a necessary opportunity to rethink how development worked in Haiti, the kinds of priorities that were given, the way that the relationship between the Haitian government and other governments worked. And I would say one of the biggest failings was simply that things didn't change enough, right, that this wasn't taken as an opportunity to rethink a lot of those. There's been obviously a great deal of work, and there's an excellent book that's just coming out by Jonathan Katz today about this that details it in great at great length, I think. But in many ways, the problem was perhaps a lack of imagination about thinking differently. And I would say that in some ways, the priorities and the difficulty of a kind of a correspondence between outsiders' priorities and Haitian priorities was one of the major obstacles.
Give us some details of the 1804 slave revolt revolution in Haiti. I mean, it goes back to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, of course, Napoleon, and a lot of intrigue. Just a thumbnail of what caused that.
Yeah, it's of course connected to all those the major revolutions, the American Revolution and the French Revolution of the age. But really the central story of the Haitian Revolution, what makes it so important and so unique is that it was a revolution carried out by enslaved people. They were the ones who launched it. They were the ones who theorized it and put it into action. And ultimately it was former slaves, a former slave named Dessalines, who founded the nation of Haiti in 1804. So what you have is a revolution that really came out of a plantation system, of a slave system, a system that dominated all of the societies around Haiti at the time and issued this incredibly profound challenge to really the way the whole world was ordered around it at the time. So that's I think, a critical thing to remember.
And why do you think it succeeded where other uprisings in the New World had failed?
Well, there's many reasons for that. One is simply the kind of correlation between what was happening in France and Haiti created a kind of unique opening. And part of the story is the story of alliance between some radical Jacobins and radical revolutionaries and certain slave rebels in Haiti. So that's a key part of the story. The demographics of Haiti were not totally unique, but they were, of course, part of the story. There was 90% of the population was enslaved. The geography was part of it as well. And, of course, one can't, I think, overlook simply the brilliance and genius of many of the leaders who were able to see through what others were not able to elsewhere.
When you say the geography was part of it, what are you referring to?
So partly because Saint-Domingue, which is the colony that became Haiti, was on the border with another colony, Santo Domingo, today the DR, the fact that there was that border there actually allowed for rebels to kind of get support from Spain. Its proximity to Jamaica and other places just created some military opportunities as well as trade opportunities that gave some support to the revolt.
And how did this tie in with Napoleon and also then the Louisiana Purchase?
Well, it's critical to that because, in a sense, Napoleon reacquires Louisiana at the moment of this revolution, in part because he's trying to reverse what has gone on in Haiti. He's trying to kind of push back emancipation, and he sees the acquisition of Louisiana as part of a kind of new wave of French empire in the Americas that centers on reestablishing control and slavery in Haiti itself. So when his troops, he sends tens of thousands of troops to kind of reassert French control over Saint-Domingue, and when they fail to do so, when they're decimated through war and disease by the Haitian revolutionaries, it's at that point that he actually turns to the United States and sells Louisiana. So we actually owe quite a bit of a debt to Dessalines and to those Haitian revolutionaries in this country.
How about more on Toussaint?
Well, Toussaint is one of the most fascinating historical figures I know of. Certainly, he's a person who's born in slavery, who becomes free before the revolution and becomes a kind of defining voice within that revolution. Astute politically, a kind of powerful speaker, but also one very aware of the imperial context. And he has fascinated generations and generations of novelists and playwrights and historians, and I think will continue to do so for some time for those reasons.
What were the repercussions of this revolt in the U.S. and other slaveholding nations?
Well, obviously this was a challenge. It was an inspiration for slaves elsewhere. They could look to Haiti and say it succeeded there, right? An uprising succeeded. And that, of course, frightened slave owners as well. So it had kind of dual consequences, both inspiring other revolts and also in some ways creating a kind of reaction. As well. In the long term, when we're thinking about the U.S. and Haiti, we have to go back to that to understand the image of Haiti in the United States imagination, the way in which Haiti was figured in the U.S. as a kind of a threat, as a danger very early on in its history. And I think that's become part of our culture in America about the way that we think about Haiti as well.
You stated, going back to the earthquake, you stated that 50% of U.S. households gave to Haiti earthquake relief, but alongside that involvement, there's an absence of knowledge about Haiti. Is that the kind of thing you're referring to, that there's some fear? And what other factors, what else do you think we're not aware of about Haiti that we need to know?
Part of it is the fear. It's almost as if there's a kind of unconscious image in America about Haiti. And if you kind of scratch the surface, I talk to my students or just ask people what they know about Haiti, you know, certain things will emerge, the zombie, voodoo, you know, certain kind of images. So people have kind of some vague images about Haiti. Now, obviously, there are a lot of Americans who know Haiti well, who travel there, and they have a very different experience that's a direct experience. But there's also historical things that we know very little about. And one of the big points in the book was simply to emphasize that one very important historical fact, which was the U.S. occupation of Haiti, which lasted 20 years in the early 20th century, which profoundly shaped the country and our country's relationship to Haiti. And it is striking, I think, how little knowledge there is about that, since it, of course, shapes the way Haitians view us as well.
We're speaking with Professor Laurent Dubois. His book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. Professor, when did you last visit Haiti and what did you find?
I was there at the beginning of this past year, so a few years after the earthquake. We run a laboratory here at Duke University where we focus a lot on contemporary Haitian situation. I've been struck, I think, now this year at the ways in which the kind of, I think people are really realizing that we're moving out of the phase of post-earthquake Haiti and into kind of a longer phase of reconstruction. But exactly what that's supposed to look like is still very much in the air. And I think there's a lot of unease about where Haiti's going and exactly what the future holds.
How about the role of NGOs post-earthquake? Have they done much good or have there been problems?
Well, there's been a mix. I mean, Haiti has a huge number of organizations working, often in a rather fragmented landscape. And this is something that many people know and lament. Paul Farmer details this in a recent book as well. So you have lots of different organizations, anything from very small groups linked to church groups to very large international organizations. I would say one of the things that at least I've learned in learning more about the NGOs is that those organizations that really have a very firm grounding in the very specific Haitian reality and the very specifics of Haitian reality are often the most successful. And so after the earthquake, I think those that had a long, kind of long experience and understanding of what how Haiti was organized did a great deal of good. Now, obviously, emergency help after the earthquake also was very, very important. But in terms of reconstruction, it really has to start from that deep rooted knowledge of the specifics of Haiti itself.
We're speaking with historian Laurent Dubois. He's a professor at Duke University. His latest book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. It's today's topical currents. We're going to take some calls and emails when we return, but we're going to take this short break first. Please stay with us.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. St. Philip's Episcopal School is a three-year-old through fifth-grade school offering a strong academic program in the Episcopal tradition. You're invited to an admissions open house at 9:30 a.m. on January 9th. Details at stphillips.net.
North Broward Preparatory School hosts an open house on January 27th at 2 p.m. North Broward Preparatory School offers an enriched curriculum that fosters critical and creative thinking supported by innovative educational technology. Students experience a personalized approach that enables them to succeed in school, college, and beyond. North Broward Preparatory, you can be part of an extraordinary community. Reservations at 954-247-0179 or npbs.org.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking about the new book by historian Laurent Dubois, professor at Duke University. It's Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. Questions about Haiti, you can call with them at 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or you can email with your questions radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Professor Dubois, why has Haiti experienced so much poverty and political instability? Do you think it's the fault of France and the United States, or does the instability originate from within, or both?
Well, definitely both. I mean, I think, and this is really what the book tries to explain, is how a lot of external pressures on Haiti kind of combined with some very serious internal conflicts within Haiti over what freedom should look like, over the economic structure of the country. And those have, in a sense, both come together, I think, to create this situation. Now, on the other hand, one of the points I make is I think we make a mistake when we think of Haiti as a kind of uninterrupted series of failures. In fact, much of the 19th century in Haiti was a time of relative economic prosperity, of an expanding coffee economy. And there's a set of systems that were put into place in Haiti that actually have been quite strong and have provided a good livelihood for Haitians at certain times. So we have to kind of understand also where the successes have been, I think, in order to build on those for the future.
So let's talk a little bit more about the successes. Can you, you know, tell us what they were? You say agriculturally, and what else?
Well, I think the great challenge coming out of the Haitian Revolution was to create a kind of new society, right, that was very different from the plantation order. This was a society founded by people who had – most of them had been slaves on plantations. And what they wanted to do was create something that was very, very different from that, obviously. So how does one go about doing that, right, in a context in which the whole society had been built around plantations for export? And so what Haitians did was created what a sociologist I quote Jean Casimir, a Haitian sociologist, calls a counter-plantation system. A system that was really about guaranteeing a kind of autonomy, land ownership, ability for families to be kind of rooted on the land and reproduce, a combination of producing for one's own consumption and then exporting certain goods. And they did that. They built that in the 19th century. And I argue in the book that in the 19th century, this was actually probably one of the best places for people of African descent in the Americas to live. And you can see that in African American culture, where there was great admiration for Haiti here in Durham. In fact, there's a neighborhood called Haiti in honor of the country itself. So there's a kind of sense that people understood that success in the 19th century.
Well, when did things begin to go awry?
Well, there were always difficulties, obviously, and conflicts over this in the 19th century. And there are long-term problems, environmental problems and agricultural ones. But a lot of the problems actually, I think, are more 20th century ones. And they have to do partly with the ways in which that system came under persistent attack. It came under attack during the U.S. occupation. Outsiders and insiders in Haiti, many of them have always basically thought that only a kind of plantation system or a large-scale agricultural production or else certain kind of industrial models could successfully bring Haiti out of poverty. And what's happened is a kind of conflict between that vision and the kind of the ways in which Haitians have responded to that and refused that. And so you have, a kind of impasse that continues to cycle through Haitian history and continues to this day over what development should mean, over what prosperity should really mean, and how that's linked to critical things like dignity and autonomy and freedom.
So what do they think it should look like, the majority of Haitians, as opposed to the leadership?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think first of all, Haiti is still a majority rural country, and Haiti has a very diverse rural setting. I think there's still a lot of investment in a kind of idea of land ownership and independence, but also a prizing of independence, of a kind of ability for entrepreneurialism, for in some ways self-employment and the creation of one's own wealth out of that. Now, the problem, of course, is that all takes place in a context in which infrastructure is very weak, in which people have to confront many, many difficulties in pursuing some of those goals. And so you have a problem in which obviously the question of the state itself and its difficulty in providing infrastructure undermines a lot of the aspirations of Haitians. The problem is that the way in which aid is currently structured and the way in which things are going, I think, is really not addressing that fundamental problem at this point.
And so what do you recommend?
I mean, I think one of the problems after the earthquake, and it is a sort of cycle that was in a way unfortunately predictable, was that there's been such a long process of international organizations having a deep suspicion of the Haitian state, and then things that the Haitian state has done that have sometimes confirmed those as well. That what you have is a situation which very, very tiny amount of aid ever goes to the Haitian state at all, and instead it's routed through other kinds of organizations. And as people are counting up the way that money was spent after the earthquake, that becomes very clear. The problem with that is that in the end, I think many would agree that only a kind of strong Haitian state can really provide the kind of infrastructural foundation for economic expansion. And right now we're not going in that direction.
We have some calls.
Yes, we do. This is Tony in West Palm Beach. Welcome. Hi.
Hi, this is Tony Thomas. Hello, Lauren.
Hey, Tony.
Can you talk about you talked about how great Haiti was doing in the 19th century. Can you think of any country in the world that the United States has had such a determining influence over its life and history as Haiti in the 20th century and the early 20th century? And then when people talk about blame the Haitians for their condition, blame might be elsewhere. Okay, mm-hmm. I'll take my answer off the air and
All right.
See you.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very important question. And one of the basic things I want to put forward before people with the book is to say, look, over the course of the 20th century, the United States has been deeply, deeply involved in Haiti. So if, you know, when to the extent that there are very serious problems in Haiti, we shoulder some of the blame, we share some of the blame. Now, that's not a simple equation. It's never been only one way, but it is a very important thing to realize. The U.S. has had a very, very intense role in Haiti throughout the 20th century. It starts really with the occupation. It really starts before, but culminates in that occupation from 1915 to 1934. And then since then, the United States has been really the most powerful external force determining situation in Haiti. So now what do we do with that? I think part of it is that, of course, we've had lots of different types of influence. There have been very positive ways in which citizens of the United States and communities in the United States have interacted with Haiti. And there also have been very negative ways. So I think part of the issue is that Haiti is very close to the United States. It is seen by many people in the United States as, you know, a kind of ultimate site of victimization and poverty. It's also, though, very close by. And that's one of the reasons for the proliferation of different NGOs and groups working in Haiti. It's easy to get to and at the same time seems very far away kind of culturally. So now all of that is done with, I think, in well-meaning ways. And again, there are positive things that come from it. But if we take a step back and look at the whole way that this is affecting Haiti, I think we have some soul searching we really need to do and think about how might this all work differently. And in that sense, I would say there are examples of, I think, more positive ways of interacting that one can draw on.
What was behind the first U.S. occupation?
It's a complicated story. I mean, the United States became very interested in the Caribbean generally for strategic reasons. This has to do with the Panama Canal. It's the time at which we acquire Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Obviously, Puerto Rico is occupied. Cuba is occupied. The Dominican Republic is occupied. Central American republics. So it's part of a bigger story. Haiti is part of that. In 1915, and specifically, it's the beginning of World War I. There's a German presence in Haiti that is kind of used as a justification for the occupation. But really what's going on is that underlying it, U.S. companies are very interested in moving into Haiti, in building railroads and rebuilding plantations. They see it as a kind of zone of economic opportunity. And that's the kind of the real push behind the occupation. Like many such events, it begins, I think, without the U.S. really understanding what they're getting into. There was really, I think, very little intention of staying for 20 years. And over time, the occupation kind of set in motion a war and anti-U.S. movements and a number of processes that really completely changed a lot of Haitian society.
Was that beyond the beginning of the corruption in Haiti?
I would say, I mean, I think there's always been
the occupation.
There's been problems of corruption, certainly in the 19th century. What changed actually is that it's an odd thing to say in a way, but in the 19th century, the Haitian central government was quite weak, and it was actually regional powers and regional militaries and regional ports that had a lot of the power. And that actually helped a lot of Haitians. I mean, it provided a kind of economic access that would ultimately disappear. Actually, the centralization and the creation of a strong state in Haiti could have been a good thing. I mean, in many ways, it could be a positive thing. But the way that it happened through the U.S. occupation and then later under the Duvalier regime was that this centralized state became almost entirely a repressive state. It didn't provide, it didn't offer that much. It did offer some things, but it largely became a kind of a centralization of power. And so as power might have often been corrupt, but when it became centralized and corrupt, that was even worse than before.
And why did they stay for 20 years? What was that reason?
What happened partly was that they arrived in 1915. Within a few years, they had stirred up a major uprising, in part because the Marines used forced labor to begin to build roads and in the countryside, and that stirred up a revolt in a country that, you know, was based on anti-slave revolution. One could have imagined that. After the revolt was suppressed and the U.S. Marines kind of suppressed that insurrection within Haiti, there was, I think, a kind of new wave of a desire to have a kind of better version of the occupation. So there was a lot of investment put in kind of a education infrastructure, in public works projects. Actually, the National Palace, which was recently finally demolished after having been destroyed in the earthquake, was completed during this time. So in some ways, there was a desire, I think, of the United States to kind of justify its presence there by showing it could be a positive presence. But in the end, actually, the kind of resistance that had been a military resistance then became a kind of cultural and urban resistance. And ultimately, major strikes and uprisings by students kind of convinced the United States to leave.
And let's take another call. We've got Remy in Parine. Hello there.
Yeah, I've heard so much. It's a little bit of a whitewashing of American foreign policy. There's a reason why there's so much hostility in the Caribbean Basin. But before we get to that, Haiti started from the moment of independence with a tough road to follow. The first thing that happened, and your guest could elaborate on this, is Napoleon Bonaparte. He requested reparations. In fact, he threatened the new nation with reinvasion and re-enslavement. So there was crushing debt day one. They've done very well considering how much the rest of the world was against them. And he could mention how the fact that the United States failed to ever recognize them as an independent state. I'll take the response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that is obviously part of the story. The French did demand indemnity, which was eventually agreed to by the Haitian President Boyer in 1825, created a cycle of debt that Haiti went into very, very early, where they couldn't pay the indemnity, so they took loans from French banks. They did eventually pay off that entire indemnity by the late 19th century. But by then, there were new banks, both the U.S. and French banks, that had been giving loans. So you have a long history of a kind of the Haitian state being sort of starved, effectively, having to pay these large foreign debts and not being able to invest locally, which is certainly part of the story. And the United States was the last nation on earth to recognize Haitian independence, not until the Civil War in 1862, after the secession of the Southern states, because Southern senators and others simply could not allow or wouldn't, you know, said they wouldn't allow black diplomats in Washington and allow kind of recognition of Haiti. So we do have that history with Haiti, absolutely. And I think that's really a key part of the story. But it's also a difficult story because there's ways in which Haitian elites and Haitian leaders at different times have collaborated with that or have contributed to that. So the story does, you know, have to go back to that
issue
as well.
How do they contribute to it?
Partly, it's true that the indemnity agreement was agreed to by Boyer against the wishes of the parliament and against the wishes of many Haitians. But so having a kind of an autocratic ruler at that time played into that decision. But it's also true that more broadly in the 19th century, Haitian elites and Haitian rulers had a very interesting problem in some ways. They had to figure out how to deal with this rising power of the United States. And as I said, there were some who really reflected on this as a positive thing, a kind of collaboration with the United States and Haiti that could have taken shape. And I talk about one great Haitian intellectual, Antenor Firmin, who dreamed essentially of a kind of collaborative relationship with the United States where the countries could really work together. Unfortunately, I think the form that the relationship has taken has tended to be one of a kind of very powerful country taking advantage of or controlling another country instead of that kind of collaboration. And that has partly been sometimes because elites, actually many Haitian elites in fact welcomed the U.S. occupation in 1915. There was very little open resistance at the time for reasons that had to do with their own interests. So that is part of the story as well. I do think that their role and their kind of difficulty that the Haitian governments have been placed into is enormous. And I think one should never forget the kind of pressures from outside and the internal conflicts and their situation is one that I try to talk about with some sympathy in explaining the choices they've made.
We're speaking to professor and historian Laurent Dubois, and his latest book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. We're going to take another break and take more of your calls when we return. Please stay with us.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. NPR for the Florida Keys is 91.5 WKWM, and we're streaming online at WLRN.org.
Time Out New York calls Bach's Goldberg Variations one of the most demanding pieces in the keyboard repertoire. Simona Dinnerstein's 2007 recording of the Goldberg Variations ranked number one on the U.S. Billboard Classical chart and was named to the Best of 2007 lists for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the New Yorker. Dinnerstein will perform the entire Goldberg Variations on January 13th in the Knight Concert Hall at the Arst Center. Information at arstcenter.org.
I'm Ashley Milne-Tight. This Tuesday on The Broad Experience, we look at how race can play out at work. Two guests with quite different perspectives weigh in. That's The Broad Experience this Tuesday at 5:50 p.m. during All Things Considered on WLRN.
And we return. We continue our discussion about Haiti and its history with Professor Laurent Dubois of Duke University. Professor, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
We have something called the Haiti Laboratory at Duke, and I would encourage people to Google that, where we have lots of resources, students and faculty who have been contributing all kinds of knowledge about Haiti. So that would probably be the best place. It's at the Franklin Humanities Institute, and it's called the Haiti Laboratory.
Will you tell us more about that? That was a question I had for later. I still want to go back to the indemnity, but tell us more about the Haiti Laboratory.
Duke gave us the opportunity just a few months after the earthquake. We opened our doors in September 2010 to create a place where humanistic, historical, and cultural knowledge about Haiti would be at the center of a discussion of the kind of the context of the country. We worked with the law school, with global health. Duke has a clinic in Léogâne, Haiti, focused on women's health and other issues. So we worked in collaboration with them, but always with this kind of agenda of saying, look, let's go back to the history and culture. We offer courses in Haitian Creole. We've got a lot of graduate students and undergraduate students doing research on everything from epidemiology to the history of the demography of the country and other issues. So the idea is to really kind of gather minds together and gather a lot of different approaches together to think holistically about Haiti in order to see the way forward.
Any relationship to the Miami Haitian community?
We do have a number of links. Actually, we just finished a semester where Edouard Duval-Carrier, who's a Haitian artist, of course, in Miami, well-known, was here teaching, and I taught a course with him called Visions of Haiti, in which we explored the kind of visual depictions of Haiti in relation to its history and culture. We made an art project with Edouard in which faculty and students created a kind of large installation that's now on the wall here at Duke that kind of tells the story of Haiti's history and its present. So those are links. And we have a number of colleagues who work and teach in Miami, Chantal Verna at FIU and others who have been part of our projects as well. So we do – obviously Miami is a crucial capital for Haitians in the United States and globally, and we've had a lot of links with that.
And you plan on continuing this lab?
Yes, we'll be short of moving from being in the Franklin Humanities Center to probably another location and reconfiguring a little bit what we're doing next year. But we will continue to do this and offer – what we're trying to do also is to offer students a way to combine we have a lot of students interested in health, for instance, but we're trying to give them a kind of sense that cultural and linguistic knowledge is a key part of that. And so all those things will be continuing. And we do now offer a full 2 years of Haitian Creole, which we'll be offering also virtually with some other universities starting next year. Because the language, obviously, training is absolutely essential. And one of the great things in Miami is Miami's really taken a leadership in terms of getting Creole language broadcasting and television and so forth. And we consider that very important as well.
Yeah, we have
some Creole language broadcast.
Radio L'Ecole, yes, every night at, I guess, 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And that's critical. I mean, it's, you know, that's one of the basic kind of things that has to be overcome is this kind of linguistic division in Haiti. And, you know, we just want to make sure that more and more people have access to Haitian Creole, which is also just an incredibly interesting and wonderful language for anyone to learn.
Again, we're speaking with historian Laurent Dubois. He's a professor at Duke University. Should you have any questions and want to join in this conversation, the name of the book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. Our number is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or email is open. That's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Before the call, I just want to ask why they agreed to pay the indemnity. I don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's again something I try to detail in the book. It's something that they had refused for a very, very long time. But the fact of the matter is, Haiti didn't really have a strong navy. They needed places to export their goods. Because France was refusing recognition, they kind of were holding Haiti hostage because other countries, other empires were not going to recognize Haitian independence until France did, since France was the former colonial power. And so in the end, the calculation made by Boyer was that the economic benefit from getting recognition finally would outweigh the negative consequences. But that, I think, in many ways turned out not to be the case. It's still a very, very kind of controversial and sort of a bitter issue for Haitians because they do feel like not only did they pay with blood when they overthrew slavery and freed themselves, they then literally had to pay France again for their freedom and with long-standing consequences. So it's something that's certainly not forgotten.
It seems like it should be the other way around. France should be giving reparations to Haiti, I would think.
Right. Yeah. And there's been debates. Obviously, you know, President Aristide famously in 2004 asked for France to pay back, you know, essentially pay back what the Haitians had paid them. And there's ongoing debates about that. I mean, I think the issue now is that is how that relationship should play out. But you're right. I mean, I think a lot of Haitians feel like first they worked as slaves and created enormous profits for France, because one also has to go back to the 18th century and realize that a lot of France's economic expansion, just like the United States, was based on slavery. It was based on the labor of these slaves in Haiti.
Right.
So in fact, I mean, I quote in the book somebody who says, you know, we've paid for this land three times, you know, first through the sweat of, you know, unpaid slave labor, then through our blood, through the revolution, and then having to pay France for an indemnity. So, I mean, this is something I think, you know, people who are interested in Haiti need to know, and it's something Haitians obviously remember with quite a bit of fury.
Roughly in today's dollars, what would that indemnity be?
Oh, there's been like lots of discussions about that. I mean, it's at the time it's 150 million French francs. That's then diminished to 90 million French francs. But the problem, the reason it's hard to calculate is because, of course, then you have to think about the loans that were taken out to pay the indemnity and the interest and so forth. So people make estimates into the billions of, you know, 20 billion euros or $20 billion dollars today. It's really obviously difficult to make an easy calculation, especially because the indemnity itself was actually paid off by the late 19th century. In fact, Haitian governments were very assiduous about paying their debts, but they were also so starved for cash that they contracted new debts through the process. It's a case in which the sort of situation that we're familiar with now, African nations and others who are in debt, you know, those are nations that have been going through that for maybe, you know, 20, 30 years. Well, Haiti's been going through that for almost two centuries. So that is really an issue.
And we'll take another caller. This is Lloyd in Perrine. Welcome, Lloyd. Hi.
Well, thank you for welcoming me to your show. Enjoy the conversation. I worked in Haiti after the earthquake for Humane Society International, and almost everything I found about Haiti was wrong from what I had been told. I was told there was great famine, there was no food, and yet on one side of the street I would see starving people with no food, and on the other side of the street I would see piles of produce and livestock, fruit, vegetables, from vendors on the street trying to sell it. And what I recognized was that there was not the money in the economy for the people on one side of the street to purchase it. Then when we came in with all of our charity and all the NGOs giving free stuff away, we kind of damaged what little of a working economy there was by putting the people who had it to sell out of business. I think had we gone in with all that capital, taken the produce, the products, the livestock from one side of the street, distributed it to the other, we could have done a lot more good and done a lot less damage to the economy than we did.
Professor?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really key point. It's true that, for instance, a lot of international organizations actually import their food, for instance, and a very simple thing would have been to draw on that, those kind of producers in the country. I have – my own opinion is that one of the greatest problems with the reconstruction effort is that there was not sufficient focus on the agricultural and market economy.
Well, that's
Haiti
why I was
long,
there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're really right. And I think that's – I mean, we've been starting a workshops around that here, and I think it's a critical zone. Haiti, for much of its history, had provided its own amount of food and even exported food. And it's really over the past decades that that's been eroded. And a lot of it has been eroded through development policies and IMF policies and so forth. So I would say a foundational thing will be to get Haiti – if we can get Haiti back to a place where at least that food is made available through internal production as much as possible, that would do a lot towards improving the lives of both rural and urban communities in Haiti. Unfortunate that it hasn't been. Yeah.
I was actually sent by Department of Agriculture and Humane Society International to assess the damage to the animal agricultural infrastructure. And so that's what I was there for, actually.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's an organization I particularly think is great that's based here in North Carolina called CODEP, which is a reforestation group that's worked in Laogan in the South. And they've had remarkable success kind of just literally recreating forests. And those forests then become the basis for, you know, for fruit trees and for an economic policy. So I think those kinds of approaches, and that, of course, does affect how urban life is, because, of course, it's the departure from the countryside that creates so much pressure on the cities and creates Beau-Prince as a city which is, you know, just overwhelmed by the population in terms of its infrastructure, and obviously that contributes to the horrible death toll during the earthquake. So all these things are connected.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your work.
Tell me, Professor, what precipitated the rise of Papa Doc Duvalier, a country doctor, to such immense power?
Well, he emerges out of this very kind of murky and complicated period in Haitian history between the U.S. occupation and then his election in 1956. There's about 20 years of a lot of different conflict, really, again, over this question of what kind of society is going to be born, what role the United States has. It's a kind of case where he came to power with very, very, I think probably no one quite suspecting what was going to emerge out of that regime and how long-standing it would be. He comes to power in 56 out of an election still very disputed, exactly whether the vote counts were right and so forth, a very election that involved a lot of fighting and violence as well. And then slowly begins to kind of consolidate his power, first of all by striking out against the Haitian military, which had at times supported him but represented a kind of alternative pillar of power within society. There's a number of attacks against him by exiles, and over time he becomes kind of increasingly paranoid and focused on kind of preserving his power at all costs. He develops this very strong infrastructure of Volontaires de Sécurité Nationale, they were called, known as the Tonton Macoute, kind of popularly, that becomes a kind of force throughout the country of control. And he also uses very effectively a kind of nationalist rhetoric, arguing that he's a kind of representative for the black population of Haiti. So he draws on these very powerful cultural movements that had emerged in the 20s and 30s and kind of articulates, you know, he himself was an intellectual. He published academic articles. He actually studied in the United States in medical school for a year as well. So he's able to kind of create a kind of discourse of power that is also very powerful. I mean, it leaves a huge mark, obviously, on Haiti over the 30-year period of he and his son. And I would say it's something that still has to be really fully reckoned with, all the influences of those eras. And it's someplace where right now it's actually the Haitian novelists who are really writing that history more than even historians or certainly than state institutions. So it's in Haitian novels you can really find a lot of depictions, powerful depictions of that era and kind of what it did to the society. Finally, it's very important because it is what really kind of sets in motion and creates this huge Haitian diaspora all over the place in North America. So it's pivotal in that sense. And the whole question of how the Haitian diaspora relates to that history and to Haiti itself is obviously one of the great, great questions and very important questions for the future.
Why don't you name a few of the Haitian novelists that you spoke of for those listeners?
So obviously Miami's own Edwige Dandicat is a beautiful writer and has published remarkable, among other things, her memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, which talks about this past is a beautiful, beautiful book. Marie Vieux Chauvet, who wrote in Haiti at the time of the Duvalier dictatorship, and her work has been translated. There's a recent book by Lionel Trouillot, called La Belle Amour Humaine that has not been translated into English yet, although some of his other novels have, and a host of others. There's actually a very, very rich and lively literary culture within Haiti itself, written a lot of it in French, some of it in Creole. Much of it is not translated, which is unfortunate, but it's a really exciting literary and cultural landscape.
Professor, when and what began your passion and interest in Haiti?
Well, I was in an undergraduate in college in the 1980s at a time when Haitians, as I'm sure you recall, were blamed for having brought AIDS to the United States. Mm. This was a period of the boat people coming to Miami and elsewhere. And at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, you had this kind of wave of blame, quite devastating against Haitian communities. I just became interested in that really for political reasons and was concerned just about this kind of accusation that was going on, read about it. There was a lot of movements, protests against this in New York and elsewhere. And I became curious at that point, just try to understand how it was that our country would sort of focus blame on this group of people, why this seemed to make so much sense to people that Haitians were to blame for this new epidemic. And that's what pulled me back into the history. I had grown up speaking French, so I was able to read a lot of the Haitian literature and sources. I studied the U.S. occupation of Haiti as an undergraduate. And then I just became really fascinated by the history and by all its kind of ramifications on the modern world, and sort of haven't stopped since.
And we'll move along to another caller. This is Chloe in Miami Beach. Hi.
Yes, hello. Yes, I was hoping to move back more to the present and the anniversary of the earthquake. And I had a chance to become involved with an international NGO here, a number of young architects, and we were asked to design a new orphanage. The orphanage had collapsed, and we were in contact with nuns there. And it, just to sort of speed ahead, and my question is not very politically correct. I don't know how you're going to receive it, but I would say that we ended up extremely disillusioned. I could, you know, describe our encounters with the, what we were asked to do by the nuns. We wanted to bring quality of life to children who had gone through trauma and at no cost, and we were told, no, don't make it nice because they'll never want to leave. And I think we just ended up extremely disappointed and disillusioned in our interlocutors there. And around the same time, I was listening to a program on the BBC, and their analysis, they were critical of some of the NGOs, you know, that are basically run like businesses now and are insensitive to local cultures. But the reporter said something that you wouldn't really hear on a lot of American radio, which was basically attributing a rather passive and resigned character to the role of religion in Haiti. And I wonder if you would comment on that. I mean, we can go back to history, but is there something in the present, the way Haitians are responding to disaster and tragedy, that is perhaps attributed to the role of religion?
Well, I'll take first your full point. I think that, you know, what you're describing is shared by a lot of people. There are a lot of people who work in Haiti and end up quite disillusioned, who feel like they, you know, they go in with projects that don't follow, that don't work out, that a lot of the interlocutors are problematic. I mean, I described this at the end of the book. I think there's a lot of frustration on both sides, actually. And I think, you know, that's something – so it's nothing – you know, there's nothing to be shamed about, I think, in that respect. I do think that's a structural thing, right? And I think we have to sort of take a bigger look at this, because I do think a lot of people are expending a lot of energy in trying to do good, and they're finding ultimately they're feeling a bit disillusioned and not sure why what's going on. And I think, you know, that's part of the challenge, is to figure out how this can be done differently. With regards to religion, I mean, religion in Haiti is for one thing extremely complicated. It's such a diverse landscape, from Haitian voodoo, which is itself diverse and regional, to different Protestant organizations, to, you know, from the Episcopal Church to Pentecostals to the Catholic Church itself. My own experience is I myself would not describe Haitian religious culture as one promoting resignation. I do think it's a crucial, you know, it's a crucial place through which people deal with this incredible loss, with the mourning of the earthquake and other aspects. I mean, Haitian voodoo actually has a very kind of energizing and kind of revolutionary quality. It's very shaped by the history of revolution and resistance. And I think, you know, in each case, people make their own choices. But I think a lot of times, too, religious communities can be a kind of source of assistance to other people. But, you know, I would tend to be wary of a kind of broader statement about religion in Haiti or in anywhere else, just because I think, you know, it can obviously lead people to lots of different places. I do wonder, you know, I think there's also just a long-term culture related to the culture of aid itself. And that is something shared between Haitians and foreigners, right? The difference partly is that what happens is that new people arrive in Haiti all the time from abroad without necessarily understanding the context they're going into, whereas Haitians are in that context and they see these people arriving. And that creates a kind of strange relationship, I think, that, you know, needs to be talked about a little bit more honestly. But the kinds of experiences a lot of people have in Haiti are really important to kind of plumb and to think about carefully.
What do you think the next step should be for Haiti, and what kind of involvement do you think the United States should have, and other nations for that matter?
Well, I'm kind of two minds about this. You know, I think that there's a lot of good that could potentially be done in Haiti, and yet the track record to me has been so often negative that at times I feel like maybe the best thing to be done would be to pull back to some extent. I feel like there are types of projects and work that have been done in Haiti that's very good, that's very strong, that is really kind of building capacity for Haitians, that's doing something important on the ground. So I'm certainly not – I don't think there's any, you know, need or room for hopelessness. But I also think that to some extent some of the big ideas that are kind of projected onto Haiti without taking that much into consideration what Haiti is are going to, I think, again and again kind of founder. So unless there's a real kind of critical perspective and a self-critical perspective on what people are doing there, I don't think that there's going to be much advancement. Now, I have enormous, you know, I think that there's a huge amount of hope and possibility, you know, kind of within Haiti, and there always has been. And this is a country that has gotten back to its feet again and again and will continue to, you know, push forward its own vision. So in that sense, I think that's going to keep going. I do wish that we could take a step back and to think critically about our role and maybe try to be more imaginative and
well,
more
professor,
self-critical about that.
We've just about run out of time. We certainly want to thank you, historian and Professor Laurent Dubois. His book is Haiti, The Aftershocks of History.
Thank you, Professor.
And thanks for tuning in. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page with author and book links and more. And there are free program audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program considers a new WLRN-TV documentary follow-up. It's Weird Florida with history raconteur Charlie Carlson and producer Mia Lorenzo. And to the calendar. On this day in 1933, 80 years ago, the birth of CBS News journalist and poet-in-residence Charles Osgood in New York City. He was inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame in 1990. And on this day in 1935, 78 years ago, the birth of Elvis Aaron Presley in Tupelo, Mississippi. He was first billed as the Hillbilly Cat. One more before we tiptoe away. On this day in 1965, 48 years ago, the arrest in Miami of Jack Murph the Surf Murphy. He robbed the Museum of Natural History of the fabled Star of India Diamond in 1964. He was later convicted of a murder committed near Hollywood, Florida. Today, Murph the Surf is a prison ministry preacher. Go figure. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And we leave you with a thought from Charles Osgood, who is also a gifted pianist. Quote, "There are no exceptions to the rule that everybody likes to be an exception to the rule." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.